From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, actor, screenwriter, and director Billy Bob Thornton. He just won the National Board of Review's Best Actor Award for his performances in the films The Man Who Wasn't There, Bandits, and Monsters Ball. Thornton also wrote, directed, and starred in Sling Blade, starred in A Simple Plan, and co-wrote The Gift. We'll talk about acting, writing, growing up in Arkansas, his mother's psychic abilities, his marriage, and his phobias. Billy Bob Thornton, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Justice Department has opened a criminal investigation into the collapse of Enron, the giant Texas-based energy company. A Justice Department source tells NPR that a task force has been formed to conduct the investigation. Enron filed for bankruptcy last year, revealing that much of the company's debt had been concealed in partnerships that obscured the company's financial problems. The bankruptcy cost company employees billions of dollars because the company had blocked them from selling shares from their retirement accounts. The Treasury Department announced today that it's frozen the assets of another four entities believed to be linked to the Al-Qaeda network. NPR's Andrea Seabrook reports.
Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill added the names of two individuals and two organizations to the list of suspected supporters of terrorism. He said the groups fronted as charities, supposedly collecting money for widows and orphans, while funneling cash to Al-Qaeda. The Treasury Department is trying to keep terrorists from exchanging Afghan money into harder currencies like dollars or yen. O'Neill called the world's financial capitals, such as New York and Tokyo, the choke points in the international monetary system.
Shutting down terrorist access to the money center nations is the key to preventing them from purchasing the tools of their evil.
O'Neill also sent technical assistance teams to help nations beef up systems to identify and block terrorist bank accounts. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, Washington.
The Massachusetts man accused of beating another father to death at their son's hockey game testified in his own behalf today. He told a Cambridge court he was acting in his own defense. NPR's Tovia Smith reports.
Thomas Junta, on trial for allegedly beating another hockey dad to death, presented himself to jurors as a concerned father who was only trying to protect his young son from rough play. Junta says he was upset that Michael Costin, who was supervising the kids, wasn't controlling the game. He says he fought with Costin and landed, quote, three quick punches. But prosecutors asked the 270-pound Junta why he didn't just walk away from the much smaller Costin.
This is a 156-pound man flat on his back holding onto your wrist, and you want this jury to believe that you couldn't get away from him?
Yes, I do. That's the truth. That's what happened. He had my wrist.
He had your wrist?
Yes.
Junta broke down in tears when he recalled that his then 10-year-old son and several other children watched the fatal fight. The case goes to the jury Thursday. Tovia Smith, NPR News.
Search and rescue teams are at the scene of a military plane crash in Pakistan, but so far there have been no reports of survivors. The plane was a KC-130 refueling plane with at least seven Marines on board. The U.S. Central Command says the plane crashed into a mountain as it was preparing to land at an airstrip in southwestern Pakistan. In stocks, the Dow lost 56 points today, the Nasdaq lost 11. This is NPR News. Police in California say they've arrested a former worker at a nuclear power plant for allegedly making terrorist threats. The sheriff's office in San Juan Capistrano said the man is David Riza, a 43-year-old former mechanic at the nearby nuclear generating station. A sheriff's spokesman said deputies found 54 weapons in Riza's home and more than 200 in a storage locker. In a telephone interview, Riza told the Orange County Register that he's being discriminated against because he's a Native American and because he has a disability dispute with Southern California Edison, which runs the power plant. The State Department is again calling on Russia to protect press freedoms, arguing it appears political pressure is behind a case against an independent television network. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
State Department spokesman Richard Boucher says there have been unusually rapid developments in a case brought by the oil company Lukoil to liquidate TV6. The station has been providing work for reporters who quit the NTV network, which was taken over by the gas monopoly Gazprom last year. Boucher noted the same law was used against both networks.
We think the case raises a number of very important issues: media independence, fair and transparent application of business law, freedom of Russia's judiciary from political pressures.
Secretary of State Colin Powell raised the issue of press freedoms when he was in Moscow in December, and to show support for TV6, he gave an interview to the station's director. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Lawyers for the Justice Department argued today against televising the federal trial of Zakaria Moussaoui, the man accused of conspiring in the September 11th attacks. Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing customized approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America, on the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is actor, screenwriter, and director Billy Bob Thornton. This week, Thornton received the Best Actor Award from the National Board of Review for his role in three films, The Man Who Wasn't There, Bandits, and Monsters Ball. He's probably best known for the 1996 film Sling Blade, which he wrote, directed, and starred in. He also co-wrote and starred in One False Move, received an Academy Award nomination for his supporting role in A Simple Plan, directed All the Pretty Horses, and co-wrote The Gift. Let's start with a scene from Monsters Ball. Thornton plays a corrections officer at a state prison in a small rural town in Georgia. He heads the team that handles the execution of prisoners on death row. His son has recently started to work on the team. It's the night before a scheduled execution of a prisoner who's African American. Thornton's character is a racist, but he takes his job very seriously, particularly the rituals surrounding the condemned prisoner's final hours. In this scene, he's at a bar talking to his son, who made a mistake during a run-through of protocol for the execution.
It's like I said, no more mistakes, all right? I want to make damn sure nobody makes any mistakes, especially you. It's when it gets time for us to do it, you know. You can't mess up. That goes for me, too, and the rest of them. You ain't no different than us. You can't screw it up. In England, they go as far as to give a guy a party the night before. Call it the Monster's Ball. They don't want no lawyer, no preacher, or anything like that around, so it's just you and me. Like I said, you can't think about what he did or anything else about him. It's a job. We have to do our job right.
Billy Bob Thornton, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
Was there a prison in your town in Arkansas when you were growing up? Did you have any contact with prison life or prison guards?
Really, the only contact with the jails I mostly had was through an uncle of mine who was a sort of a rogue. Every now and then, my mother would wake us up in the middle of the night and say, we have to go to Greenville, Texas, and get your Uncle Don out of jail. I guess my first experiences with prisons were playing music. I was a musician growing up and still play music, and I actually played at a couple of prisons. One was a female prison, actually, that I played at a couple of times, and it was very strange, I have to say.
What was strange about it?
It was the first time I ever knew how women feel around, like, construction workers. It was...
Were they hooting
really
at you?
Yeah, it was that kind of thing. Since then, I mean, you know, since I became an actor and everything, I've shot in several prisons. I've been at the New Mexico State Prison, Oregon State Penitentiary for Bandits. Years ago, a movie called Blood In, Blood Out that we did in San Quentin, and Angola, in this case, for Monsters Ball. So I've been around a bunch of them.
You've written several films. You didn't write Monsters Ball. When you haven't written a film that you're acting in, do you ever rewrite your own lines?
Yes. I don't think I would call it rewriting them. I don't even rewrite my own stuff. But I improvise within the structure of what we've already got. You know, it's like a. I usually do it just on the set. I'm sort of an improvisational actor. The only movie ever that I didn't improvise in was The Man Who Wasn't There, the Coen Brothers movie I just had out. Not because it's a sticky plot necessarily, but just because it's just one thing. It's like one animal, their screenplays, and you sort of need to stick to it to make it all make sense. And I actually ad-libbed one line in the whole movie, and I asked them if I could do it. That's the first time I've ever done that, too. I just said, hey, listen, guys, do you mind? There's just something I want to say here. And there's a scene in the movie where this young girl and I have this car accident, and it's because she's sort of trying to toy with me in a sexual way, which I'm not ready for. And I say heavens to Betsy. That was my one ad-lib line, and I got that because my wife and I are big fans of a cartoon, a Hanna-Barbera cartoon called Snagglepuss. And Snagglepuss used to say, heavens to Murgatroyd and heavens to Betsy all the time.
Why don't we hear that scene?
You know, I really do appreciate the interest you've taken. I just wanted to make you happy.
Bertie?
No, it's really okay. I want to do it.
Bertie?
No, it's okay, really.
No.
Mr. Crane, I
no.
want to do it. Mr.
No.
Crane!
Bertie,
Mr.
please don't
Crane,
do that.
Please!
Heavens to Betsy, Bertie!
No, please, Mr. Crane!
In your role in The Man Who Wasn't There, through most of the movie, you're almost like dead. You know, you have very little affect. You're totally alienated from everything in your life, and yet you have a lot of charisma as an actor in that role. And that seems something that's really hard to do, to play somebody who's almost dead in terms of their engagement with the world, and yet to have charisma.
Well, that was sort of the hard part of playing that role. You know, I knew that I had to carry an entire movie and yet be someone who is sort of invisible to people. You know, I mean, it's the man who wasn't there. I mean, he was someone who was ignored by everyone, pretty much, and someone who felt like he just didn't fit in this universe at all, didn't know where his place was and was looking for it. And yet he had to be the focus of an entire movie. So that it was by far the hardest part I ever played. And people often, I guess people who aren't actors would probably assume, and you can't blame them, that the very emotional parts are the hard ones, the ones where you scream and yell and, you know, toss all the things off the chest of drawers or whatever and cry or whatever. But those are really usually easier things to do because you know where you're going. You know, in other words, you have something to do. It's like oftentimes an extreme accent, something extremely different than your own, is easier to do than something that's slightly different than your own. And in this case, the part, you know, just required me to sort of be there, but I had to be thinking all the time because he's a very intense person. A lot of people are saying that it reminds them of Humphrey Bogart
yeah,
or
mm-hmm.
Joseph Cotten, people like that. But truthfully, the acting style and the person that I kind of latched onto for the part was Montgomery Clift, who was always very sort of, you know, sort of tortured and desperate, but in a very quiet way.
More vulnerable way, too.
Yeah, more vulnerable way, definitely.
Would you describe the town where you grew up?
Yeah, well, I grew up in two towns. Until I was 8 years old, I lived in a town called Alpine, Arkansas, which is out in the middle of nowhere. It's in the woods. There's not really a town. It's just kind of this valley between all these mountains. And we were sort of the only literate people there. My grandmother had been a school teacher in the old days, you know, like the one-room schoolhouse thing. And my father was going to college on the GI Bill. He'd been in the Korean War. So we lived with my grandmother until I was, like I said, about eight years old or 9 years old. And my grandfather was a retired forestry worker, and he killed what we ate, pretty much, you know. Mm-hmm. Squirrel, possum, raccoon, you know, he would make turtle soup, all kind of stuff. We had no electricity, no running water. We had coal oil lamps, all that kind of thing. And my friends in California usually don't believe that. I mean, they think that that's only from the 1800s or something. You know, kids who are raised in Los Angeles, they just don't get that whole deal.
How old were you when you got electricity?
Well, when we moved into this other town of like 9,000 or 10,000 people when I was in the third grade. That's when things started to... to us, it was like we'd moved to New York or something, you know.
So when you moved into this other town, you had electricity, running water.
Oh, yeah.
How about television, radio?
You know, I think my grandmother got electricity when I was more like five or six, when we still lived there. She got the electricity. And actually got an old black and white television set. And the reason I remember that so clearly is because she was mopping the floor, and it was a metal television set. And somehow she touched the TV standing in the water, and I don't think she was wearing any shoes, and it really got her pretty good. I remember that. It was kind of like Frankenstein, you know, electricity bad or something like that, you know. But anyway, when we moved into this town, it was called Malvern, Arkansas, which is about 20 miles from Hot Springs, which is where Clinton was from and everything, or where he went to school. And it was like all of those towns. There are all these towns that are about that size, you know, and I guess in every state, you know, and... you know, the football team is a big deal. You know, there's a country club where all the doctors and lawyers go. And, you know, it's one of those kind of towns.
What about the movie theaters? Were there movie theaters?
One movie theater. It was called the Ritz Theater, which, you know, my movies now play at, which is very strange when I go home and visit and see something. When I saw Sling Blade on the marquee, it was very strange.
Is it a multiplex now, or is it, you know, did they twin it at least?
Yeah, I think there's like two of them now. It's not like it was. I haven't been in it, actually. It's weird when I go home. I want to go home, and yet there are things there that give me such flashbacks that it's kind of tough. And part of it is this. I'm not real big on the movie business. The business end of it, the marketing and the way, you know, the state of movies and the multiplex thing like you were talking about, all that. It's kind of disturbing to me. And I remember the Ritz Theater as this great, magical place. And the movies that I saw there, at least the ones that I remember, were the ones that were just innocent kid fun, you know? I remember The Ghost and Mr. Chicken and Lieutenant Robin Caruso with Dick Van Dyke and, you know, movies like that. And we would go on Saturday, and you could stay. In those days, you pay like 35 cents or whatever it was to get in the movies. And then it became 50 cents. I remember being excited when there was a double feature. I mean, wow, we get to see two movies. And these days, people barely have the attention span to watch half of one movie, you know, and it's really, that really disturbs me. So, you know.
Did you have a place to buy records when you were growing up?
Oh, yeah, there was one record shop also. I mean, now, you know, everything's moved out of town. Main Street's a ghost town, uh-huh. You know, and you know, there's like the Walmart and all the big shopping centers on the outskirts of town. But, I mean, I loved the record shop. It was called Paula's Record Shop. It was run by an older lady. She was one of those people that when I would go back home, I would see her, and it's kind of like, you know, like how Dick Clark is always young. They're also those people who are always old.
Absolutely.
It's like she was old when I was like five.
Absolutely.
And then when I was like 35, she was exactly the same person, you know. And so it was like a music store and a record shop. And like she sold tambourines, and she had like one drum set, and she would have two or three guitars, you know, in there. And I wanted nothing more in the world than to be the Beatles, you know. I mean, that's what I wanted to be, or the Dave Clark Five or whatever. And I had little bands from the time I was like 9 years old. And so Paula's Record Shop was, you know, like going to Oz for me. It was just fantastic. And the first record I bought in there with my own money, I went in and bought I Want to Hold Your Hand, which the B-side was I Saw Her Standing There.
A good choice.
Oh, yeah, I love that song.
My guest is actor, screenwriter, and director Billy Bob Thornton. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Billy Bob Thornton. Now, your mother is a psychic, and that apparently was the inspiration for your movie, The Gift. You wrote the screenplay. It starred Cate Blanchett as a mother and psychic who investigates a murder in her town that hits very close to home. What kind of abilities did your mother have, or does she have?
When I was growing up, you know, we got a lot of flack. I think it's in the movie, actually, about the kids getting it, a bunch of guff at school for it. People would call my mother a witch and things like that. And then a lot of people would just dismiss it. But at the same time, everybody in town would come to see my mother, but they didn't necessarily want anybody to know that. So they would, I mean, especially men, they would see her in secret, you know, wouldn't want anybody to know that they did something as crazy or sissy-like as to go to a psychic. I mean, it was a very sort of redneck, male-oriented kind of society that I grew up in. But the thing about ESP, which is what my mother has, is it's not the way people think. You don't go to her and say, "Hey, am I going to meet a tall, handsome stranger?" And she says, "Yes, and it's going to be in October." You go and you talk to her. In other words, she feels things about people. She has instincts about people, and she will tell you when she gets around to it. But you can't just ask her a question and say, "Hey, is this thing going to happen?" She may not have that information for you, but she may have something else for you. Like, she'll be talking to you and she'll say, "So, have you been thinking about buying a new car?" And you'll say, "No, I don't think so. Not really." And then you'll say, "So anyway, what about this big business deal? You think it's going to come through?" And she'll say, "Well, you know, it could. It definitely could. You're sure you're not thinking about buying a new car?" "Well, no, I haven't been." And then 2 days later, somebody calls this person up and says, "Hey, listen, I got this great GTO for sale, you know?" And they buy this car. I mean, it happens that way,
mm-hmm,
you know?
Mm-hmm. Now, you called your movie about a psychic, The Gift. Did you grow up thinking that your mother had a gift and that certain talents were just gifts? There were things that you were just given. They came with you, and it was up to you to decide how to use it. But either you had that gift or you didn't. And did you think of yourself as having a gift?
Yes, but to answer the first part of it, I did think that people are born with gifts, absolutely. And I never really questioned all that. I always thought that if you had to try very hard to do something, it wasn't worth doing. And I still feel that to a certain degree. And people always talk about hard work and perseverance, but I think that the people with the creative side of the brain, I think those people are the ones, I mean, it was pretty obvious, they're the ones who are always daydreaming, they usually don't make good grades, they're always like, you know, they always have a bunch of weird things like, you know, well, like I've got phobias and different things like that. Usually just the more eccentric people, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then there are other people who are very practical, very hardworking, and that kind of thing. That was the world that I never quite understood. And although, I mean, both worlds obviously are valid and everything, but I just never related to that world. I always thought that you can either do things or you can't do them, you know? And I look at it that way, and like, for instance, in marriage, or relationships, you know. People always say, "Well, you know, marriage is hard work." My marriage is really not hard work. I've been married before when it wasn't that it was hard work, it's just that it was wrong, you know.
Right, right, right.
It just wasn't the right place to be, and there was no work to it. It was like, well, this is not the right thing. I shouldn't be here, and they shouldn't be here either.
You mentioned phobias.
Right.
If you don't mind talking about it, what are some of your phobias and how do they affect your gifts? Considering your gifts include writing and acting, do the phobias interfere with those gifts?
Well, the phobias don't necessarily interfere, particularly when I did the movie Bandits. It was helpful because I played a guy with phobias. But, you know, my phobias aren't really that much of a hindrance in my professional life or anything. I have a fear of antique furniture, certain kinds of antique furniture that I can't be around. I can be around.
Wait. not a common fear. What's the problem with antique furniture?
Well, I just get creeped out by it. I can't be around it. And there's a lot of people have this sort of simplistic idea about what that is. They think, well, it's a past life thing, and you know, something weird happened to you at a certain time, and you know, whatever. Which I don't doubt that it's a past life thing. I mean, one friend of mine said maybe I was beaten to death with an antique chair. But
excuse me for laughing.
Oh no, it's fine. You know, I don't know exactly what it is. It involves food, though. I can't eat around antique furniture. That's the main way it affects me. But anything Asian, I'm okay with. Like if something is like centuries and centuries old, if it's Asian, I'm okay with it. But if it's like French or English or Scottish or something like that, I get so creeped out I can't describe it. Like my worst nightmare is like a castle with velvet draperies and things like that.
So it sounds like a Vincent Price movie to me.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. I can't be in a Vincent Price movie. I have an unnatural fear of Benjamin Disraeli's hair.
Strange, but...
Yes, yeah. Strange but true.
Yeah, that's the thing about phobias. They're sometimes really strange.
Oh, they're very out there. And I also have a little obsessive-compulsive disorder, which is a thing to do with numbers and words. And the main way it affects me is in reading. I have trouble reading. And it takes me...
Well, how do you learn parts?
I usually have someone... like my assistant, usually. They read this stuff to me. I read a script one time and never read it again. I do that but just because that's my way as an actor.
Do you have a very good memory?
Yeah, pretty good. Pretty good memory. And I won't say it's a photographic memory, but it's close.
Right. Billy Bob Thornton will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Funding for Fresh Air is provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, promoting excellence in journalism worldwide and investing in the vitality of 26 U.S. communities, and by Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, we continue our conversation with actor, screenwriter, and director Billy Bob Thornton, and we'll listen to him sing on his new CD. We're listening now to music from the soundtrack of his film Sling Blade. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with actor, screenwriter, and director Billy Bob Thornton. He just won the National Board of Review's Best Actor Award for his performance in three films, The Man Who Wasn't There, Bandits, and Monsters Ball. He also wrote, directed, and starred in Sling Blade, co-wrote and starred in One False Move, and directed All the Pretty Horses. Now, you played in bands before you started making movies, and you even have a new CD now. What were your bands like? What was the repertoire? Did you mostly sing or play drums or both?
I never played drums and sang at the same time. I always thought that looked weird when the drummer was the singer. The only guy I could ever pull it off, I thought, was Levon Helm with the band. But I started out playing drums as a little kid, and you know, when I saw Ringo Starr, when I saw the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show, that was it for me. The British Invasion was a big deal to me, and that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be one of those guys, Jerry and the Pacemakers and the Beatles and the Animals, people like that. And we played, in my first band, we played a lot of stuff by people like that, like the Dave Clark Five. And
Did you have a British accent? What are you saying?
No, I never had a British accent, but I had, like, the narrow pants and the Beetle boots, and it's so funny. I see the way I dress these days. I still dress kind of like I did in 1964, but I mean, I still have Beetle boots. You know, wear them all the time. But we played all that stuff, all that British Invasion stuff, and then sort of the American Beatles kind of came along, which for us was like in the South anyway, was the Byrds. And so that became my deal. And actually, my record, I signed with Mercury Records a couple of years ago and have a record out now. And it's been compared to like Tom Petty and the Byrds and that kind of vibe, with a little Leonard Cohen and Tom Waits and Kris Kristofferson thrown in. But
I'll add Johnny Cash.
And yes, Johnny Cash is another huge influence on me. And see, I started out listening, because my mother is such a music fan, I started out listening to a lot of Sun Records stuff, and like Elvis Presley and Roy Orbison, Jerry Lee Lewis, and that kind of thing. And you know, Johnny Cash is on Sun Records also, and as well as Carl Perkins. And an unsung hero of that label was Charlie Rich, which to this day, Sam Phillips still says Charlie Rich was the best guy he ever had. But anyway, so that's what I heard initially. And then when the British Invasion kind of happened, My music's probably a result of all that stuff put together. I listen to Jim Reeves, Ray Price, people like that my mother listened to, it, as well as Herb Alpert. And remember Rod McEwen?
I sure do. Yeah. He had a good record label, actually. Yeah. He had his own record label in which he recorded like Marlene Dietrich. And he brought out all these like reissues from the 30s of German cabaret singers and American cabaret singers. Anyways, I'll say that on his behalf.
There you go, yeah.
Well, what did you want to say about Rod McEwen?
Well, it's just my mom used to listen to those records, and so I would hear all this poetry with sort of like birds in the background or whatever, and so as well
as
some
pretty scary stuff. Yeah,
right. And then this thing came in with the Byrds and Crosby, Stills, Nash after that, and Buffalo Springfield, all this kind of thing, and then I started listening to, you know, sort of in '67 when rock and roll became rock. 67 is when it changed to, now it's rock music. It's no longer rock and roll, it's rock. And that's when I listened to Cream and Deep Purple and Jethro Tull, you know, all this kind of stuff. So it's all that stuff mixed together is what my music really is. And my life, it's probably more like Frank Zappa and Captain Beefheart.
Why don't we hear a track from your new CD, Private Radio?
Why is this window so dirty and gray? I can't see you through it anymore. It may be the smoke, it's hard to say. The fact is, this place has too many doors. I can't find a handle on any of them. Maybe I see one, but I don't want to turn it. What if I did and it opened on him? Ain't truth a bitch when you have to learn it? Before our heart breaks, it has to bend. It's the last one to know when love comes to an end. And here I sit crazy, lonesome and sad, watching me dark and mad, watching me dark and mad.
Billy Bob Thornton singing on his new CD, Private Radio. Now, the first movie I saw you in was One False Move, which you co-wrote with Tom Epperson.
Right.
And you play just a really bad killer in this. The first scene is so violent and so... It's a very upsetting first scene.
Yeah.
And quite an introduction to you as an actor.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of movies, particularly in the Quentin Tarantino and post-Tarantino era, have been very ironic about violence.
Right.
And there's, like, not an ounce of irony. This is all for real, very upsetting. Mm-hmm. Why did you want that to be the opening scene of the first movie that you're making by yourself?
Well, I don't know that I necessarily wanted it to be. That's just the movie that we wrote, and that happened to be the one that got made. Tom and I had written other things that we didn't sell and that didn't get made. We, at one point in the 80s, had a three-picture deal at Disney. We wrote a script for them. It never got made. This mm-hmm. one just happened to be the one that got made, and it
right.
got made for very little. And, you know, it wasn't like we got wealthy from it. It was the one, though, that got us critical praise and sort of started us off in the business. So I still credit One False Move as being the movie that got me known, at least in the movie business. Sling Blade's the one that made me into a whatever, whatever I am. But One False Move is One False Move is the one that really got us working in the business. And that first scene, you're right, it's very disturbing and it's very violent, and very very realistic. The reason we did that, we wanted it to almost look like a documentary where you're really seeing these people being murdered. It was based on a case that we talked to this policeman who told us about this case that happened out in L.A. once. It was kind of loosely based on that, just that part of it, the opening. But we wanted it to look that way because, you know, frankly, I think you should be kind of responsible with violence in movies, and always did, really. And if you don't show it for what it really is, I think that is, in a way, irresponsible. And we want you to, if I'm going to have violence in a movie, I want it to be violence that's going to make people think, wow, boy, do I never want to be involved in that,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to making it look cool or hip or funny or anything else. I'd rather make it look horrible.
Well, you sure succeeded in that scene. It's a terrific film. As you said, the film you were really noticed for was Sling Blade, in which you played is mentally challenged the right word now? You played a mentally challenged man released from an institution after serving 25 years for killing his mother and her lover. As you made clear when you hosted Saturday Night Live, everyone imitates you doing that part. How did you develop the voice and the character? You wrote the story, in fact, before the movie was made. You had a short film based on the same character, and I think you did him in a one-man show also.
Right, yeah, the first thing I did was the one-man show. I'd written just the beginning, kind of what was in the short film that I did in the one-man show. I did that long monologue in the beginning there. It's based on life experience is really what it's based on, all of it. I mean, you know, the character of Carl in Sling Blade is based on a couple of different people. And I wasn't even conscious that it was based on them when I was writing it so much. It's like later on, it's like, oh, wow, you know. Matter of fact, my mother pointed out to me that part of that was like this guy that was in Alpine, you know. There was a guy who was kept up back of his family's house, and they, like, fed him sort of like a dog, you know.
Huh.
But the voice came about when I was working on a movie for HBO, and I was in the little sort of, you might call it a dressing room that they'd provided for me. I had just a few lines in the movie. I think I had four lines, and they had peeled my head because the movie took place in the 20s, and I had this really stupid looking haircut, and I just was in the trailer at lunch, and I was thinking, wow, you know what, I'm just a joke, you know. I mean, I was looking at myself, and I thought, I got four stupid lines on a cable movie here, you know, I'm never going to get anywhere. I was just kind of feeling sorry for myself, really, and I started making faces at myself in the mirror, you know, just to sort of like make it even more exaggerated. It's like, you know, it's almost like pinching a sore.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And so I made that face, and I started talking in that voice to myself. It sounds insane. Maybe it is. I don't know. But that's where I came up with that part of the character, the look and the voice. And then I said that monologue to myself in the mirror that day, that whole monologue. I don't know where it came from.
Why don't we hear that monologue?
Okay.
My daddy worked down there at the sawmill, down at the planer mill, for an old man named Dixon. But old man Dixon was a very cruel feller. Didn't treat his employees very well, didn't pay them too much of a wage, didn't pay my daddy too much of a wage. Just barely enough to get by on, I reckon. But I reckon he got by all right. They used to come out, one or the other of them, usually my mother, feed me pretty regular. So I know he made enough to where I could have mustard and biscuits 3 or 4 times a week. Well, old man Dixon, he had a boy. His name was Jesse Dixon. Jesse was really more cruel than his daddy was. He used to make quite a bit of sport of me when I was down there at the schoolhouse. He used to take advantage of the little girls there in the neighborhood and all. They used to say that my mother was a very pretty woman. They said that quite a bit from time to time when I'd be down there at the schoolhouse. Well, I reckon you want me to get on with it and tell you what happened, so I reckon I'll tell you. I was sitting out there in the shed one evening, not doing too much of nothing, just kind of staring at the wall and waiting on my mother to come in.
Billy Bob Thornton, in a scene from Sling Blade, which he also wrote and directed. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is screenwriter, director, actor, and musician Billy Bob Thornton. I want to say something about your voice when you're talking. It sometimes reminds me of Jimmy Carter, and sometimes, particularly in certain roles, of Hank Hill from King of the Hill.
That's funny.
Do you think I'm crazy?
No. I don't really hear myself, so I don't know. I mean, I know that my voice has a strange range because I sing very, very deep, you know, on certain things. And on other things, I sing really high. Like on my second record, I did most of the harmonies on the record, and I have a very, very high voice. I can sing, you know, like high harmonies and stuff. As a matter of fact, for my tour in Europe, we're doing a tour at the end of March in Europe, and I've had to hire a female backup singer to sing the parts that, you know, because the other guys in the band don't sing as high as I do. So we hired her to sing the high parts because I got to sing the low parts.
Huh.
But yeah, King of the Hill, I like his voice, Hank Hill. Mike Judge does that. He's a friend of mine. He's really terrific. I love the way he says Bobby.
That you've gotten a lot of media attention, not only for your work, but also for your marriage to Angelina Jolie. What's different about being famous than you imagine? Because most people who want to act or make movies imagine what it would be like to be famous.
Well, I think probably when you're growing up and you think, hey, one of these days, what if I'm famous or whatever? I think what you probably dream of is you dream of like the Beatles getting off at out at the airport there, and everybody's screaming at you and everything and yelling your name. And then when you get famous, it's like the last thing in the world you want. You know what I mean? It's like you just, it's like the big sort of downfall, you know, that's the bad part of it. So it's exactly the opposite of what you think you want.
And why is that? Why don't you want it?
Well, you definitely don't want, like, people with cameras following you to the grocery store. I mean, that's not fun. You just want to be left alone to do that normal kind of thing. What? Maybe at the beginning, it's probably kind of fun in the beginning,
uh-huh,
you know?
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I'm a little bit embarrassed around people. I'm not sure why, but I'm sort of an open person. But at the same time, as much as I'll talk to anybody, I'll talk to strangers or anybody, I just, you know, I'm a fairly friendly person. I'm very embarrassed in public at events. You know, I'm not comfortable with it. And, you know, like these red carpet deals and things like that, I get very embarrassed by that kind of thing. I think it's having all the attention. You know, it's like a surprise birthday party. You know, I'm terrified of that. It's like my it's my worst nightmare to have, like, to walk in my house and have, like, a bunch of people yell surprise and make a big deal and I have to open my gifts in front of everybody. I can't, actually, I've had that happen to me twice in my lifetime. Both times I almost had a seizure. I kind of feel that way. It's like, you know, when all the attention is on you. It's just, there's something embarrassing about that. And also, I think I have a lot of guilt from, you know, growing up poor and everything and then suddenly having stuff. I feel a little bit guilty about that. And my brother, who died in 1988, I always thought it should have been me. And
how did he die?
He had a heart problem that nobody really knew about. They think maybe he had rheumatic fever as a kid and they didn't know that or something. But he would never go to the doctor. But, I think he also had his time of drug abuse, you know, which I don't think helped him.
Why did you think it should have been you?
Well, I don't know. He was my younger brother. I was the one who had been sick and been near death a couple of times and had real problems with all those other things, you know. I mean, I've been clean of drugs for over 20 years, but I had a really bad time with it, and you know, the worst stuff, you know. And I don't know, he was just a really talented person. I always felt far more talented than me, and he was a sort of genius, my brother. And he was completely honest, which I am these days. I haven't always been. I mean, I mainly have been, but I mean, he was the kind of person who was so honest that, you know, the way I talk about my life these days, you know, I just don't hold anything back. And if I think something about something or someone or whatever, I say it. And my brother always did that. And I think I learned that from him, that you just say it. You say what you believe in. He always did. And I think I felt like I was a weaker person than him and all that. So I think sometimes I feel guilty of my success, about my success.
Mm-hmm.
I think he should have had it.
My guest is actor, screenwriter, and director Billy Bob Thornton. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is actor, screenwriter, and director Billy Bob Thornton. He just won the National Board of Review's Best Actor Award for his performances in three films, The Man Who Wasn't There, Bandits, and Monsters Ball. I want to squeeze in one other scene of yours, and this is from a movie called A Simple Plan. You starred in it. This is about three people who steal money they find at the site of a plane crash. And, you know, they're a little conflicted about it, but they go through with it, and in their attempts to cover their tracks, things go terribly bad. This is a scene where your brother is dropping you off at his house, at your house, and you're wondering how money is going to change your life. Now, you're playing somebody who's kind of mentally slow in this, and who isn't physically attractive, and you know your glasses are held together by masking tape around the nose piece.
Okay.
Why don't you think somebody will marry me if I'm rich?
You don't need money for that.
Hank. Hey, come on. What about, what was her name? Carrie Richards? She liked you even though you were broke, Dick.
Well, her, yeah. That was a whole different deal. That was... Her friends, they pitched in $100 altogether and bet her that she wouldn't go study with me for a month.
Jesus, Jacob. I thought you guys had a thing.
That wasn't that bad. Actually, it was kind of cool. We used to walk around together a lot, you know, take walks, you know. And we talked about all kind of cool stuff. I held hands with her one time. We were walking around, and my hand sweated so much, I kind of had to let it go. I was nervous, I guess. But it was cool. When the month was over, she... You know, kind of, she'd say hi to me sometimes on the hallway when I'd see her. She didn't have to do that. That's cool of her.
God, Hank, you know, I've never even kissed a girl before. So, you know, if being rich will change that, I'm all for it. I don't care. I just want to feel it, you know. I just want to know what people do, you know. I don't care if it's because of the money. Hank, I'm gonna be happy now, right?
Sure you are. We all are.
Yeah, that's right, we all are.
This is a very moving scene in which the character reveals a lot about himself. Could you talk a little bit about doing this scene and not turning it into a big fireworks kind of speech, but playing it really low-key?
You know, first of all, as an actor, you're trying to be realistic. And if you're talking to your brother in a car about something like that, it is going to be low-key. And sometimes, you know, I mean, well, when an actor tries to make a point of something, it's like being at home pretending you're like a rock star in the mirror or something, you know. It's like that's not... the way you should do it, you know. You should just kind of talk or do whatever it is, you know. And that scene, though, it was an emotional scene for me. So what I did really in that scene, because it was in a sense autobiographical, I put a couple of, there were a few lines that I put in there about holding the girl's hand. It was so sweaty, I was embarrassed by it and stuff like that. I had a time when I was in, you know, elementary school and junior high school when it was sort of that way for me. And so that scene was very, very close to me. And as opposed to trying to put anything more into the scene, I was actually trying to hold back because I felt a lot of emotion about it. So I was actually trying to not get emotional. So maybe that's the way it worked, mm-hmm. why it worked out that way.
One last question. What's the most ridiculous thing that's ever been written about you that wasn't true?
Well, most of the stuff that's written about me and my wife is not true. It's all either from being misquoted, from joking with people. In print, if you joke with somebody, they don't see how your face looks at the time, or they don't, mm-hmm. whatever. There's this whole thing about I'm the reincarnation of Ben Franklin, which I don't doubt, but I didn't say it in seriousness, really. I mean, I feel very close to Ben Franklin. I feel very connected to him and stuff like that, but I'm not positive I was Ben Franklin. Anyway, I think probably the most ridiculous thing written about me is that I live in a dungeon. Particularly given the fact that that's like my, as I was saying earlier, my worst nightmare.
Some furniture. Castle or,
yeah. But supposedly my wife and I are these blood-sucking vampires who live in a dungeon, and I only eat orange food, they say, and this kind of thing. It's all ridiculous. I mean, I'm having an interview at a hotel where I go a lot of times to the restaurant and I have breakfast there, and I always eat papaya. That's the first thing I eat in the morning because it's good for your digestive system. And I guess it is orange, but from that, then suddenly I only eat orange food because the waiter says, "Would you like anything else?" I say, "No, that'll be all, thank you." And then, my blood is in this little sort of locket that my wife wears around her neck, and I have hers on one also. And from that, suddenly you're like this sort of weird blood-sucking vampire.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, and I've told people this before, if you put that in a movie, if Mel Gibson gave some girl a little locket of his blood in a movie, it'd be really romantic. You do it in real life, you're a weirdo.
Well, Billy Bob Thornton, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Billy Bob Thornton just won the Best Actor Award from the National Board of Review for three films, The Man Who Wasn't There, Bandits, and Monster's Ball. Monster's Ball will open in many more cities in February. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Megan Hall, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with the title track from Billy Bob Thornton's new CD, Private Radio.
There are voices in my head and demons in my soul. Sometimes they keep me warm, sometimes they leave me cold. There are strangers in my bed.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Learning to Fall, The Blessings of an Imperfect Life by Philip Simmons. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the new 2002 cars with Paul Eisenstein, the publisher and editorial director of thecarconnection.com, an online magazine that covers cars and the auto industry. Eisenstein just attended the big car shows in Los Angeles and Detroit, where the latest models are introduced. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.